Brightly beams our Father's mercy, from His light house evermore. But to us He gives the keeping of the lights along the shore. Let the law where lights be burning, send it lean across the waves. Some poor fainting, struggling seamen, you may rescue, you may save. That song was based on a true incident that D.L. Moody described in one of his sermons in Cleveland, Ohio, there on Lake Erie. There was a ship coming into the harbor at Cleveland, and they saw the lighthouse. They saw the light. They saw where the harbor was, and so they headed for the harbor. But as they got to the harbor, one of the men on the ship said, the lower lights are not burning. And the lower lights were extremely important. They marked where the channel was, where the rocks were, so that the ship could safely get into the harbor. And so it's extremely dangerous for people to be following a light there, up there, and not to have the guidance they need to avoid the problems. And so the captain said, what are we going to do? And he said, well, we're going to make the best of it. But they wrecked, and many lives were lost. And after that story was told, Philip Bliss took that incident and wrote this song. You know, God, in many ways, from His lighthouse, beams mercy and hope to people. And they head for the harbor. But if you and I are not there to help them find their way around all the dangers that people have trying to negotiate the Christian experience, they'll make shipwreck. And many people make shipwreck because there's not somebody there. There's not somebody there to help them. And we're going to talk a little bit about that here this morning. Let's sing the second verse. It says, dark the night of sin has settled, loud the angry billows roar, eager eyes are waiting, longing for the lights along the shore. Let the lower lights be burning. God will take care of the lighthouse, but let those lower lights be burning. Let's sing the second verse. Dark the night of sin has settled, loud the angry billows roar, eager eyes are watching, longing for the lights along the shore. Let the law ding, struggling seamen, you may rescue, you may save. The story is told, I think it's probably an imaginary story. It may not be, I don't know if it's true or not. But the story is told of a sailor who was shipwrecked on a South Sea island. And as his ship was wrecked, the natives came and grabbed him and held him up on their shoulders and carried him into the center of the island. And there they put him on a rude throne and announced to him that every year they choose somebody to be king of the island for a year. And because of their motivation in seeing him out there, they decided he was to be that person. And he was pretty excited because for a whole year he could have everything he wanted. But sometime during that year he began to consider, what happened to all the other people that were kings for a year? And so he asked one of the natives, and they said, well, yeah, what happens is at the end of the year, that person is banished to an island that is completely bare and desert, and there he starves to death, and then we appoint another king for a year. Well, this man was very wise. He decided, well, I'm king for a year. I have charge of all the resources on this island. And so he sent carpenters to that other island. He sent farmers to that other island. He sent masons to that other island to plant trees and plant crops and build houses. And by the time the year was over, he had a paradise over there. And so he was banished to a lot of wealth instead of starvation. They tell me that was Sigmund Freud's favorite story. I don't know what he saw in it, but anyway. The question this morning is this. We are living on an island of plenty. Are we going to transfer that wealth to the other island? That's the question. Jesus made it very clear. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Use this stuff, just like that man used his stuff, to build himself a paradise for the future. It's exactly what Jesus told us to do. And he told us how to do it. He said, sell that you have and give alms. Provide yourselves bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens which faileth not. Now we live in a world of desperate need and unlimited opportunity to make that transfer with our stuff. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. And I have 4 points that I want to discuss. The reality of the world in which we live. The requirement. The resources. And the response. What is the reality? Can somebody tell me how many people live in our world? Well, it's just a little bit of information here. Brother Joel. Around 7 billion people live in our world. Let me tell you the reality of those 7 people's existence. 1 billion of those people survive on less than $1 a day in our money and its value. 1 billion of those people survive on less than $1 per day. Another 2 billion survive on less than $2 a day. That's if you had $2 a day in our economy, they try to survive on that day, that amount of money. Now that's 3 billion people out of almost 7. That's almost half of our world is struggling to find enough food and water to survive for just one more day on the amount of money that you would go to a fast food restaurant and spend for French fries. I just want that to sink in. That's our world. That's part of our subject this morning, our world and our wealth. Another couple more facts. Now you can go online and you can get these facts yourself. I mean, I didn't make these facts up. I got them actually from people who compile such statistics. 29,000 children die every day from starvation and preventable disease. 29,000. In fact, by the time this service is over, we will have been here about 3 hours, and 3,000 children will have died from starvation and preventable disease in our world. They die in obscurity. You don't see them. There was a group of young people that were concerned about this message that went around the country holding meetings, and one of the things they did to make this real to their audience before they said anything, before they even announced their subject, they took a goldfish bowl up to the podium with one goldfish in it, took the goldfish out and put it on the desk, and let the audience watch that goldfish gasp and flop and struggle. And on every occasion, before that goldfish died, somebody in the audience couldn't handle it, and they ran up and put the goldfish back in the bowl. Now, there are going to be 3,000 people while we're sitting here doing basically what that goldfish was doing, trying somehow to survive. The problem is that a single death is a tragedy,
But somebody has said a million deaths is a statistic. It doesn't reach us. Suppose you were starving, and suppose you knew that somewhere in the world there was a teenager who had just had to have another pair of shoes and paid for it enough money to feed your whole family for a week. What would you say? And what would you say if you heard that that person was a Christian and somebody told you what Christians believe they should do with their resources? Would you believe that Christian's testimony? You know, somebody asked Gandhi one time in India, that's another very needy place, why he didn't become a Christian, and he said, because of the Christians. And this is what he was talking about, exactly what we're talking about here this morning. 29,000 children, if you figure up the children in this county, in less than 2 days, at that rate, all of the children in Franklin County would be dead in 2 days. And all of the town, all the city of Chambersburg, which has about 20,000 people, would be dead in less than a day. We're talking about what's happening here. You see, if there's a tsunami, and we hear that 2,000 people died in that tsunami, we say, oh my, that's terrible, and the whole world mobilizes to go and help those people. My, this is a terrible tragedy. This is happening all the time. Tsunami proportionate tragedy is happening every hour of every day in our world. 850,000 people go to bed hungry on a regular basis. Well, what would it take to prevent this tragedy, this mind-boggling, horrible stuff that I've been talking about? Well, you can get figures for this too. $13 billion a year would provide the basic nutrition and fresh water for every child starving person in the world. $13 billion. You say, well, that's a lot of money. Until you realize that American Christians, we're just talking about American Christians, there are 160 million people in this country who claim to be Christians. Now, we know that that would have to be evaluated and qualified, but 160 million people profess to be Christians. Those 160 million people spend $21 billion on soft drinks. Twice the amount of money that it would take in 1 year to avoid this horrible tragedy we're talking about. American Christians spend $100 million a year on Christmas gifts. They spend $5 billion a year on bottled water. And I'm going to tell you very frankly, if there ever was an evidence of a waste in American society, it's the fact that people buy their water in bottles. Unless they really live in a place where the water is contaminated. Now that's just my personal opinion. I never thought I'd live to see the day when people would buy their water in bottles and pay the same amount they'd pay for a healthful drink. American Christians spend $4 billion a year on cosmetics. And so what I'm trying to show to you is there's more than enough wealth right here in this country. We're not talking about the whole world getting together and helping these needs. We're talking about more than enough wealth, many times more than enough wealth to meet these tremendous needs in our world, just right here in the United States. Let's talk a little bit more. The most heart-wrenching are the children who have been sold into slavery. Let me read an account. This is a true account. My sister is 10 years old. Her name is Sagitha. She is an actual person. Every morning at 7, she goes to the bonded labor man. And every night at 9, she comes home. That's 14 hours every day for 6.5 days a week. He treats her badly. He hits her if he thinks she's not working fast enough, or if she talks to the other children. He yells at her. He comes looking for her if she's sick and can't go to work. I don't care about school. I don't care about play. I don't care about anything. All I want is to bring my sister home. The only chance to get her home is to pay the bonded labor man 600 rupees. That's $14 in our money. Think about that when you go to buy another pair of shoes. Think about that when you go to buy anything. Do I really need this so badly that I am going to use this resource when someone in this world desperately needs it? You see what happens in those poor countries. Here's a desperately poor family trying to live on a dollar a day or less. And then somebody gets desperately sick. Or somebody dies and they have to pay for a funeral. Or some other unexpected emergency comes along. They have to go to the money lender. He's a loan shark. He's charging interest that is so exorbitant that it'll get ahead of them and they'll never pay it. This particular family that this girl was from owed the bonded labor man $25. And she was still in this bonded labor situation for a year. After a year, she was still there. In fact, she'll always be there. She'll never be able to pay her way out. It is because of God's grace that you were born in the United States. Try to imagine if you had been born into her circumstances. What were you doing when you were 10 years old? This girl's 10 years old. She sits all day wrapping cigarettes, tobacco. How do you feel in the morning as you walk to work if you're a person in her shoes? Through no fault of your own, you're about to spend 14 hours crouched over a basket of tobacco. Your hands and wrists will hurt. You will be beaten if you roll cigarettes too slowly or talk to the child sitting next to you. You may have a matchbook put under your chin, so if it falls, the manager will know you looked up and will punish you. You're likely to grow up deformed, unable to live a normal life. You may actually be chained to the wall. Think further. If you knew there were people in another country who could free you, what would you want them to do? What if they choose not to do what they should do? Now, that's the reality. That's our world. And there was a time when people could have said, well, we don't know those things. Communication wasn't what it is today. But today, there's no excuse. There's no excuse. We read it in the papers. You can go online. You can find, you can see the pictures. You can, the needs are just right there in front of us. And God has repeatedly admonished us and warned us about our responsibility. I want to turn to some very serious scriptures on this subject. Would you turn to Proverbs 24? You know, we talk a lot about materialism in this church. I am convinced that our theological ideas about materialism are not going to solve our problem. I finally have become convinced that that will not solve our problem. The only thing I think that will solve our problem is if this message this morning and what God has said really grips our hearts and we begin to empty out our pockets and our possessions and pour out our hearts as God intends for us to do. So we want to look at these scriptures, and I'm going to pray, I've been praying ever since I knew I was going to give this message, that God would speak to all of us, including me. And I am including me. It says in Proverbs 24, 11 and 12, if thou forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death, and those that are ready to be slain, if thou sayest, behold, we knew it not, doth not he that pondereth the heart consider it? And he that keepeth thy soul, doth he not know it? And shall he not render to every man according to his works? There will be no excuses. We're eventually going to turn to Matthew 25. And we will find there that in the judgment, this is the basis on which we will be judged. There's nothing said in Matthew 25 about how much faith you have. There's nothing said whether you were born again. There's nothing said about all the pious things that Christians talk about that you need to do to get to heaven when you die. There's nothing said in that chapter about any of those things. It's all going to be on the basis of what did you do with the needs that were around you. And obviously what that passage is saying is, the truly born again are the people who do that. The people who don't do that don't have faith and aren't born again. James says, if you see your brother have need and you shut up your bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in you? And so this is finally, when it's all said and done, this is the basis on which we will stand before God and our lives will be evaluated. And this is really, really serious. This really has gripped my heart. Proverbs 28, verse 27. He that giveth to the poor, now there's some wonderful promises here. He that giveth to the poor shall not lack, but he that hideth his eyes shall have many a curse. That's God's words, not mine. Proverbs 21. Verse 13. Whoso stoppeth his ears at the cry of the poor, he also shall cry himself, but shall not be heard. Ezekiel 16:49. You're probably familiar with this verse. It talks about the sin of Sodom. If you ask most people why was Sodom destroyed so thoroughly, they'll say because they were homosexuals, and they were. But there's nothing said in this verse about that. There's not a word said. It says this, verse 49. Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. And here it is. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. It seems to me like God puts this pretty much in the same category as homosexuality. Now, if I did something wrong there with my logic, you come and tell me after the service. But it seems like this must be just, and you know how we are so outraged at the practice of homosexuality, and should be. It seems to me that God is saying this, put this all in the same catalog here. A person who has too much stuff, a person who has too much idleness, a person who doesn't strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. I told you that that's the basis on which we're going to be judged. God takes our attitude toward the poor very, very seriously. In fact, he's looking at that. That's the litmus test. That is the litmus test. What we're doing with what we have in relation to the needs that we know exist. Let's turn to Matthew 25. I said we would get there. And I'm simply going to read it. It doesn't need much comment. I've already made my comment on it. It's a very sobering passage. Starting with verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on the right hand, Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. Then shall he say also to them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and you gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me not in. Naked, and you clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and you visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or athirst, or stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not unto the least of these, ye did it not unto me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous unto life eternal. And so when it's all said and done, most of what's going to be preached this morning as what you need to do to get right with God will miss the mark. It'll all be about faith. It'll all be about abstract theology. It'll all be about being born again. And those things are all important. Don't you go away and say they weren't. But none of that is a reality if the Lord can't look at it and see this? That's the proof. In fact, when John the Baptist had people come to him, and he said, I want to see evidence of repentance. I want to see fruits. And they said, well, what are you looking for? And he said, well, if you have two coats, give one away. If you have extra food, give it. That was the proof of repentance. When Zacchaeus had the Lord come visit him, he finally said, behold, half of all my goods I give to the poor, and if I've taken anything from anybody that I shouldn't have taken, I'll give them fourfold in return. And the Lord didn't say, well, Zacchaeus, you sort of have the cart before the horse. You really need to get born again first. No, he said, this day, salvation is come to this house. And you can just go through the scriptures. The great theme of the Bible, the great practical theme of the Bible, there are other themes there, but the great practical theme of the Bible is justice and equity. Are we really passionately, and I'm going to use the word passion, is it a passion of our Christian faith that we equalize this inequity that we see all around us? Is that our passion? That's a question. I'm afraid in the past, although I involved myself in some of that, and we all have, I must admit that has not been the passion that some other things spiritually have been in my life. This should be the number one passion of my Christian faith. And so, if you see me waste my money on clothes I don't need, a lifestyle that I don't need, you can say, wait a minute here. Wait a minute. Do you really care about the many people in our world who will have to starve because you used more than the resources that were allotted to you? That's the question that Jesus is going to finally confront us with. Luke 16. I mean, the Bible is just full of this. And we read these verses and we get used to them. And we don't think about them like we should. Or like until I prepared this message, it didn't grip me like they should. But by God's grace, I want to change more and more into the image of Jesus and these verses. Luke 16, verses 19 to 25, and I'll read these pretty much without comment. And there was a rich man which was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. And that's all of us. That's everybody sitting in this audience. And there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, which was laid at his gate full of sores, and desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. And in hell he lifted up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried out, saying, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, you should have been born again. Is that what he said? You didn't have faith. You didn't go to the altar. You didn't surrender your life. There's nothing said about that. For, as far as I know, this man probably was, he could have been. We're reading between the lines, and that's always a dangerous thing. But he could have been. For what we have in this text, he could have been the model Jew, keeping the law to the nth degree, with no blame. There's only one thing that he's faced with in the judgment. It's the very same thing we saw in Matthew 25. It's the very same thing we're reading in the Old Testament. Here it is. Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and Lazarus evil things. That's it. That's the basis on which God disposed of his case. You had the stuff, Lazarus didn't. Well, Lord, I gave him scraps. I mean, I sent my clothes to the clothing center when they were worn out, or that I didn't want them anymore, and I wanted to redo my closet. So I sent lots of clothes to the clothing center because I bought lots of new clothes, and I sent lots of shoes there. And I said, Lord, I did. They were scraps. Sorry, they were scraps. Can we embrace Jesus and walk away from these needs? We know that when he came here, it says he had bowels of compassion. He'd see a multitude of people, and we have instances where thousands of people were brought to him, and it says he healed them, and every one of them, individually. It must have taken him all night. That was how he responded to need. The great blind spot of American churches, and the great blind spot, I would say, of Anabaptist churches, is this. You know, it's hard for us to understand how you can have such a blind spot, but consider, the churches in this country at one point had a blind spot about slavery. I was at a place last Sunday, and it was a conservative Mennonite man whose father was a conservative Mennonite man. And he said, my father would never have tolerated bringing blacks into the church as members. And I said, why? That's just what my father believed. Well, what were they supposed to do? I don't know. And we say, how in the world could anybody be so ignorant of a basic concept of the gospel? Just like we are. It's possible to read scriptures and look at the gospel and hear it preached and miss a major concept of the gospel. And I think that's what's happening here. Well, the atheists understand what Christianity is supposed to be. They understand. I understand there's an atheist website, and I didn't go to the bother to try to look it up, but I understand there is one. I heard it described. Where there's a website where they play Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, sweet little song with children singing. And while they're playing it, they have pictures of children emaciated and dying and starving to death. And they flash these pictures while they're singing Jesus Loves Me, This I Know. And then at the end, they have a picture of a cross with a circle with a slash through it, which means don't, not. And then they say at the end, he is your God, these are his rules, and you will go to hell. That's the requirement. We've talked about the reality, we've talked about the requirement. Let's talk about the resources. The United States is the richest nation in history. There never has been a nation that even has come close to the wealth of this nation. Every one of you is living a life that's far beyond anything the kings ever dreamed of having in the past. We have half of the world's wealth. We are 5% of the world's population. Did you hear me? We have half of the world's wealth, and we are 5% of the world's population. If all the 160 million people in this nation who call themselves Christians would give $15 a month, all the needs of our world physically would be more than met. That's all it would take, $15 a month. Now, I know there are situations in the world where the problem is a political problem. You can't even get the stuff to them. I understand all that. We're only talking in terms of possible figures. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 8. You know it's one of my favorite passages. Let's talk about some positive motivation. Some of what I talked about got pretty negative, and I wanted it to be pretty negative. And I wanted to continue to settle down with all of its negativity on your hearts, like I'm hoping and praying it will settle down on mine. But we want to look at 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And I just quoted this verse in my prayer this morning, verse 8. But I want you to see the context of this passage. We say, oh, we want all grace to abound toward us, that we always having all sufficiency in all things. Oh, my, that's a wonderful promise. Lord, just do it to me. Well, it's in a context here. There's a condition on all of this. Here's what he says. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly. And he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity. I mean, don't go out of here and say, I better give more money because I want to go to heaven when I die. Don't, none of that. God won't record any of that. For God loveth a cheerful giver. And Brother Lynn told us one time, and I wrote it in my Bible, that that word cheerful is the word hilarous. Hilaros, H-I-L-A-R-O-S. God loves a hilarious giver. He wants you to give sacrificially and do it with hilarity. And then, verse 8, on that basis, God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound without any limits unto every good work. And you might look at that verse and say, well, why isn't that happening? Well, I told you why. It's conditional on whether you are ready to go to the hilarious level with your generosity and your wealth. We won't turn to all these passages again. The Bible's just full of this. Are you aware? Somebody has estimated that one third of the New Testament, at least, in one way or another, speaks to this subject. There are far more verses on this subject than there are on prayer or any other subject except the kingdom of God. This is a very prominent theme of the New Testament and the Old. We say the Roman Catholics with their means of grace are wrong. And so we say there are no means of grace. Well, there are means of grace. Matthew chapter 6 says, if you give of alms and you do it in the right way, secretly, without making a show of it, God will reward you openly. That sounds to me like a way to have God's grace poured upon your life. Luke 16, verses 10 to 13. I think we'll turn to that one. I think we forget this parable sometimes. It's my favorite parable, by the way, of all the parables in the Bible. It says, there was a certain rich man that had a steward. Now, a steward is someone who's in charge of somebody else's wealth. And somebody accused the steward that he had wasted the Lord's goods. So the Lord called him. Now, this isn't God. This is his Lord, his human master. And said unto him, how is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest no longer be steward. I'm going to fire you because you have not been a good steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I can't dig. I think what he meant there is he's too lazy. And to beg I am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. I need to prepare for my future here. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him and said unto the first, how much do you owe my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said, take the bill and sit down quickly and write 50. So he's still doing what he's going to get fired for doing. He's still giving away his Lord's stuff and wasting it. And he said to another, where are we here? Well, I'm sorry. Then he said to another, verse 7, and how much owest thou? And he said unto him, 100 measures of wheat. And he said, take thy bill and write 80. So he gives him 20 measures of wheat. And the Lord, his human master, commended him. And basically what he said was, the guy's a jerk, but boy, is he ever a clever jerk. Because he knew that when you invest resources like he was giving stuff away, you make friends. And then if you have any needs, you have lots of friends. I was talking to Brother Josh McConaughey, and he said, you know, we're coming on hard times, and he was saying the same thing I've been saying. Very shortly, things are going to change, as far as I'm concerned. And he said, people talk about getting stuff together and having, he said, there's no point in stockpiling food. The man with the biggest gun and the most ammunition is going to have the food. So he said, he's pursuing a different strategy. He's trying to be generous to all the people in his little community. That's what he says. That's what he's saying. I told Josh, I said, you got Luke 16 right. All right. Verse 8. And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world have more smarts than the children of light. We don't understand that to do what Jesus told us is for our benefit, even in this world. He had a Lord that didn't want him to give away his wealth, and he did it anyway. We have a Lord that says, give away your wealth. And we think, and he says, you're not smart. The world would tell you that that's a smart thing to do. Let's continue. And I say unto you, make yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. I'm not sure what all that means. I don't know if it means in this life or the next or what. I have no idea. But the point is that you've prepared for yourself a good future. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in least is unjust also in much. And here's the interpretation. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, that's the least, who will commit to your trust the true riches? You know, everybody wants spiritual gifts. They want abilities to do all kinds of spiritual things, miracles and whatever all else. And Jesus says, before God gives the real gifts, he looks at what you've done with your stuff. We have it in the parable of the talents. The men who took the talents that they had and used them the way the Lord wanted them to use them, they got more talents. The man who buried his in the earth got judged. And I honestly believe that if we use the material things God has given us, this passage says it, we qualify ourselves for greater gifts, for greater usefulness, for greater opportunities, for greater ministries. I really believe that. That's what this passage is teaching. And if you've not been faithful, verse 12, in that which is another man's, and that's the money, the stuff, not just money, all material things, who shall give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either will hate the one and love the other, else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And by the way, if you preach this message, you'll get the same response he did. The Pharisees made fun of him. And he said, you that are rich, justify yourselves. But what is esteemed in the eyes of men is abomination to God. And this is the subject he's discussing. Well, let's turn to Isaiah 58. We won't turn to all these passages that I have listed here. These are just, the Bible is just full of this. Isaiah 58, verses 10 and 11. It's talking about the subject of fasting, but in that subject here he says this. Verse 10, and if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall thy light rise in obscurity and thy darkness shall be as the noonday. And the Lord shall guide thee continually and satisfy thy soul in drought and make fat thy bones, and thou shalt be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters fail not. The person who draws out his soul to the needy. You know, let's take a real life example. Now, I know John Wesley did not do everything the way we thought he should have done it. But you know, he did do this right. And it could be that in the Lord's estimation, this is what he was looking for. And the infant baptism and maybe not even non-resistant, I mean, you know very well, I believe those are parts of the gospel. And they need to be obeyed. And not to obey them when you understand them is disobedience. I want to make that clear. But John Wesley had those things that weren't the same as what we would say they should be. But he had this one right. And if it is true that this is what God finally focuses on, then that'll explain what I think happened. John Wesley made a salary in today's money of $160,000 a year. He wrote lots of books. He made lots of money on his books. But he chose, early in his life, to live on $20,000 a year in today's money. That meant that he had $140,000 a year every year to give. We visited the Wesley Museum in London. It was amazing the influence that man had. It didn't matter if it was the jail, the poorhouse, orphans, slaves, he poured out his heart to the people who were in need. He provides us some insight on how to make decisions by a little story that I read. Wesley had just finished buying some pictures for one of the rooms of his house. When one of the chambermaids came to his door, it was a winter day, and he noticed that she had only a thin linen gown to wear for protection against the cold. He reached into his pocket to give her some money, which was his custom. I mean, if there's somebody came to Wesley with a need, and they did, because they knew that he would just give them whatever he had. He reached into his pocket to give her some money for a coat and found he had little left. It struck him that the Lord was not pleased with what he had done with his money. He said to himself, "Will thy master say, 'Well done, good and faithful steward. Thou hast adorned thy walls with the money that might have been, that might have screened this poor creature from the cold.' O justice, are not these pictures blood, the blood of this poor maid?" Now, were the pictures wrong? No. But what is wrong is when we make those kinds of decisions without this in mind. And this. And I know it's happening. I know it's happening. And we will never get a handle on materialism until we get a handle on this one. I'm convinced that we can teach against materialism till the cows come home. And we will continue to become more and more materialistic until this grips us. Until we realize that at the end, this is where we will stand with God. It's not a mystery to me that it was said at Wesley's death. Wesley left to the world a battered hat, a worn coat, a tattered Bible, and the Methodist Church. And it didn't just happen. It was cause and effect. I believe that with all my heart. It's interesting that Hurricane Katrina brought many, many people to help. And the people in New Orleans, I'm quoting somebody else, I obviously wasn't there to witness this. The people in New Orleans finally got it through their heads that the people who came and stayed and most sacrificially labored for their benefit were Christian people. And a Jewish doctor said not too long ago, there are no more atheists in New Orleans. Because you see, the world understands this. One of the Roman historians said the secret to the tremendous power and influence of the early church was how they poured out themselves for the poor and the needy. I mean, if there was a plague in the city and all the other doctors left, the Christians stayed and risked their lives. Wherever, the picture you get when you read those accounts is wherever there was a need, the Christians were there. And sacrifice gave their money, their wealth, their time, their lives. That's what they did. They believed, apparently they had a grip on this better than we do. And that's all they were interested in, was pouring out God's grace and the wealth and the resources they had on anybody who had a need. Eric Camille visited this church. I've been talking to Eric Camille. And Eric said, "You have a beautiful church." He said, "I thoroughly enjoyed being there. And I think we do have a beautiful church." But he said, "The problem is, it's in the four walls of your building." He said, "I didn't gather that you're going to take it to the streets. And that the people in Shippensburg will finally realize who these people are and what extent they are willing to go to use their resources for the needs in Shippensburg." You might say he's a little bit radical. But he does not ever plan to join an Anabaptist church because he said that's how they all are. That's how they all are. They meet in their little temples. And he said, "They're beautiful people. They're righteous in many ways. They obey the gospel like other people don't. All but this." Now Jesus said, "Keep my commandments that your joy might be full." What do you get your jollies out of? Jesus said, "You will get your jollies out of keeping my commandments." But you see, we think we have to have a certain... And I'm not going to mention anything because then you'll say I'm picking. But we think we'll get our jollies if we have this, or we have this, or we have this, or this level of living, or, you know, this. That's what we think. And Jesus said, "You will get your jollies, your joy will be full if you do what I tell you." Now, there was a church where that was being preached, and so somebody decided to do it. And so this is what they did. I'm going to just read you the account. "My wife and I went home, emptied all our extra clothes onto the bed, got several bags of extra canned goods and all the baby clothes our son had grown out of, in addition to the toys he didn't play with anymore, And besides that, I took along several hundred dollars of cash that I was saving to upgrade the front lawn. And I'm amazed at what people spend on their lawns. And drove over to the projects downtown and prayed. Now, I'm not saying you have to do this. This is what this man did. I prayed for the people I didn't know who were about to receive what I had too much of. In the first house, there was a man of 30 who had a baby who needed some, a man with a baby who needed some work clothes. Perfect. I gave him the clothes. He needed money for groceries. I gave him $100. The next house had a couple who needed some clothing for the wife and money for a car payment. So I gave her my wife's clothes and they gave them $100. And I prayed for each family and told them we came with God. Now you can question the wisdom of that. I mean, there are people who are not poor because they need to be poor, and you can decide what you need to do with it. I think we spend too much time analyzing that, if you want my frank opinion, and don't spend enough time analyzing what we should be doing. This is what he said about the experience. I got such a rush from doing this that my wife and I immediately went home and got together more things to give away. Now you know, and I know, that when we've done this, that's what happens. There is a tremendous joy that we never get in those things that we think are going to give us pleasure. They turn, eventually, if we're honest. But this gives genuine joy, like Jesus said. Keep my commandments, and the reason I gave them to you, I want to fill your joy to overflowing. But you won't be joyful if you don't do what I told you to do. We are to overcome evil with good. That's what we're supposed to do. If we could ever do what I've been describing this morning and couple that with our non-resistance, our suffering love, we would have the most powerful testimony in this community. All right? My question at the end of this message, will we be remembered as the generation that rose up to radically obey this very prominent teaching of Jesus and do our part to overcome a world full of greed and oppression? Or will we prove to be the most selfish generation in the richest nation yet that loved its soft drinks, its fancy cars, and I'm quoting, by the way, its cosmetics, its extravagant clothes, its expensive gadgets, its oversized houses, and its costly vacations? That's the question. In light of these two things, will we be known as the richest nation and the richest bunch of Christians who love these things more than they cared about what Jesus said and what the basis on which they're finally going to meet God and the reality of the world in which they live, which gives them all kinds of opportunities to completely deplete their resources and lay up treasures in heaven? It's not the high cost of living. It is the cost of high living. When my mother had twins at the end of the family, my father decided to put a bathroom in the house and get her an automatic washer and dryer. Now, before he did that, we all took a bath once a week. And we changed our clothes once a week on Saturday night, so that people would be able to stand us in church on Sunday morning. On Monday morning, my mother got up. She had a big double-dexter wringer washer. She had 11 children and herself and my father, 13 of us. We were farmers. There were a lot of dirty clothes. No, there weren't many because we only changed them once a week. So she got up early Monday morning and she washed all those clothes, and her washing was done. When the automatic washers were put in and the bathrooms were put in, we all took a bath every day and changed our clothes, and she washed every day. Did she have more time? No. When I was a boy, my mother and father took us to visit almost, I'd say we visited at least 1 or 2 days a week. And we didn't visit on Sundays, and we never called anybody. You just got out and got in the car. We children would say, if we get the work done tonight early, can we go visiting? Okay. So we'd get the work done, and then we'd all pile in the car, all 13 of us, in a 2-seat sedan. That was an interesting experience. My father would not have a station wagon because he said he couldn't reach the back seat, and he had children to keep in line. So we sat in 3 layers, and that was in the days before polyester, and I can still see my sisters get out of the car with their cotton dresses and say, just look at my dress. Anyway, So we would load up in the car and we'd go down to visit uncle, and well, uncle's not home. Well, we just kept going to the next uncle until finally we found somebody home, and that's what they did with us. We'd look out the lane, here comes Uncle Russell's. Oh, we'd hurry around and make the house look halfway presentable, and we had a nice evening. We don't do that anymore. I don't know of a single person in this congregation that does that or maybe would even tolerate such behavior. It's not the high cost of living. It's the cost of high living. Now, I think it's good to take a bath every day. I don't know about changing clothes every day. I think there's just way too much washing of clothes, and it wears out the clothes. It's expensive. It costs detergent. It costs hot water. You've got to make new clothes because washing clothes wears them out. If you take a bath every day, I'm not sure you have to change more than once a week unless you do very dirty work. Will we insist on a few moments of pleasure, or will we invest in eternal pleasure by rescuing the perishing, which is a song we maybe can sing at the end? I'm fully convinced that the key to freedom from the deadly nature of wealth, and it is deadly. If you want to wonder, if you want to know why this congregation doesn't have more power, and I'm not here criticizing that it doesn't, but if it ever entered your mind, how could we have more power and be more effective and get more accomplished for the kingdom of God? It's wealth. I'm convinced there's nothing that will kill spirituality like wealth. So here's my statement. The key to freedom from the deadly nature of wealth, and it is deadly, is extravagant compassion and extravagant generosity. And a sense of reality. Here's my concluding story. It's a true story. In the late 1940s, well, first of all, I want to say, we are in a battle. We're not on a vacation. We're not on a picnic. We're not on some kind of a luxury trip. We are in a battle. Read Matthew chapter 10. I was just impressed recently. I mean, Jesus was preparing a group of people to go out to spiritual war. And it wasn't a pretty picture. He told them what was going to happen to them in that battle. So we're in a battle, but here's a story. In the late 1940s, the United States government commissioned William Francis Gibbs to work together with the United States lines to build the largest troop carrier that was ever built for the United States Navy. It was to cost $18 million in the 1940s. It was to be able to carry 15,000 troops speedily during war. In 1952, the SS United States was completed. It could travel 51 miles per hour. It could go 10,000 miles without stopping for food and supplies. It could carry 15,000 troops. It could travel anywhere in the world in less than 10 days. It was the fastest and most reliable troop carrier that the world had ever seen. The interesting thing about it is it never carried any troops. Somebody got the idea that it would make a wonderful luxury liner. And so they converted it into a luxury liner. And until they were done, instead of carrying 15 passengers, it carried only 2,000 passengers. It had 695 staterooms, 4 dining salons, 3 bars, 2 theaters, 5 acres of open deck. It had a heated pool, and it was fully air-conditioned. But it was no longer a vessel for battle. It was a means of indulgence for a few wealthy people to come across the Atlantic on a luxury trip. Is this a troop carrier, or am I looking at a luxury liner? I'll let you answer that question. Are we willing to make the richest country of the world a means for exalting Christ through the investment of our resources? That's the question. Now you can go home and say whatever you want to about this message. But this message won't amount to anything unless something happens, unless we're different after we walk out of this building. In the last century, I gave this story before, but I'll give it again as a conclusion. An American tourist paid a visit to the renowned Polish rabbi, Hofitz Chaim. He was astonished to see that the rabbi's home was only a simple room filled with books, a table, and a cot. The tourist said, "Rabbi, where's your furniture?" And Hofitz Chaim replied, "Where's yours?" "Well, I'm only a tourist. I'm only passing through." And the rabbi said, "So am I." Shall we bow our heads for prayer and then we'll stand for a song, and the song will be number 765.